You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
If they fired a missile at you and the flame from the missile stayed in a fixed position on your canopy, it was coming to you.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
Welcome to episode 28 of Cold War Conversations in partnership with the Cold War Museum. Today we are talking further with US Air Force pilot Buzz Carpenter. We talk about flying reconnaissance over Vietnam, the Skunk Works where secret US Air Force projects were developed, his time commanding Ramstein Air Base at the end of the Cold War, and more. Thanks to all those who are supporting the podcast with monthly pledges and donations. It is much appreciated and will allow us to continue to expand the scope of the podcast. If you donate more than $5 a month, you get extras from the cutting room floor. And this week's episode's extra is a great anecdote from Buzz, where he describes an encounter with Jimmy Doolittle, who was awarded the Medal of Honor for personal valor and leadership as commander of the Doolittle Raid, a bold, long-range retaliatory air raid during World War II on the Japanese main islands, only 4 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor. If you would like to support the podcast further and get access to these exclusive extras, go to our website at coldwarconversations.com and click on the Support the Podcast menu option. Back to today's episode, where Buzz continues his story of his time in Vietnam, his work in the Pentagon, and when he served as wing commander at Ramstein Air Base. Welcome to Cold War Conversations, Buzz. The first question I had was, why did you enlist in the Air Force?
I came from a family that was my dad was an aeronautical engineer. He worked in testing airplanes in World War II. He was a civilian. My godfather was an aeronautical engineer. One of my uncles was an aeronautical engineer. And so I kind of grew up and I always wanted to fly. I dreamed about flying. And when I was probably somewhere between 8 or 10 years old, when you used to go to the movie theater, they used to have the news of the week. And this particular time was the dedication of the Air Force Academy. And I just, it really caught my attention and motivated me. So that's how I ended up in the Air Force, because I applied for and eventually got in the Air Force Academy and graduated from there and went to pilot training and spent the better part of 28 years flying different airplanes.
Wow. And so when did you graduate from the Air Force Academy?
I graduated from the Air Force Academy in June of 1967.
Right. Okay. And then you had further pilot training after that?
Yes. The pilot training was another year, and that took place outside of Phoenix, Arizona, at a place called Williams Air Force Base. And you went through, you had about 30 hours in a Cessna 172, a propeller airplane.
Yeah.
And then I want to say you probably had 100 hours in the T-37, which was a primary jet trainer. Mm-hmm. And then from there, if you passed all the tests, you went into the T-38, which was our high performance trainer at that time. And I would later fly the T-38 because the T-38 was our companion trainer when we were flying the SR-71, because when we were home with the SR-71, we would get about three flights a month, anywhere from 2.5 to 4.5 hours. But then they tried to schedule you for at least 8 flights a month in a T-38, which was typically an hour to an hour and a half on each one of those flights.
Okay. Well, we'll come on to the SR-71 because I have got, unsurprisingly, a few questions for you on that. So what was the first aircraft that you flew operationally?
When I graduated from pilot training, I went to fly C-141s. At that time, that was the Air Force's largest transport. And I flew out of an outfit in Georgia. And we were a special mission. I flew worldwide. And, Ian, it was wonderful because I flew into Europe, into the Middle East, at least once a month. I flew into the Far East, to Vietnam, supporting the Vietnam War. And it really taught me how to be a pilot in a very world environment, because you would land in bases in Europe that were very normal, you know, with approach and the right kind of nav aids. And you could also land in North Africa, where you flew over this runway and there was nobody in the tower, and you tried to figure out which the active runway was. So
right.
It really taught me a lot about flying.
Yeah. Okay. And what did you volunteer for that aircraft, or were you, you know, they looked at your aptitude and thought, oh, this guy's really suited to fly the Starlifter?
No, it was a question of the order of merit. You graduated in your class, you actually picked the airplane that you wanted to fly. And from a position in my class, I was kind of in the middle. So when I got my chance to pick, I wanted to stay in jets. I didn't want to be an instructor. Mm-hmm. And the C-141 to me seemed like the best choice.
Yeah.
Now, very shortly, I mean, I was only in the program 2 years, and I volunteered to go to Vietnam. And because I'd upgraded to being an aircraft commander in the C-141 as a lieutenant, it then qualified me to fly any airplane going to Southeast Asia. And I wanted to fly a fighter, and there were no fighters available during the 2 month block period that I needed to go into a different kind of training. So they offered me an RF-4, basically a photo reconnaissance F-4 airplane. And I accepted that assignment, and that's how I got into reconnaissance.
Right. And that's the plane that we're familiar with as the Phantom, isn't it?
Exactly. And I ended up with about 1,100 hours in RF-4s, also as an instructor pilot. But I flew out of Saigon in South Vietnam, and then out of a base called Udorn, which was in northern Thailand, before eventually ending up in Okinawa, Japan, for the last 3 years that I was in the RF-4 program.
Right. And what were your missions with the RF-4?
The RF-4 was either pre-strike. They give you a series of targets in Vietnam, and you go out and take pictures. And then when you came back, they would process it. And those were the pictures they would give to the targeteers to identify targets. And also many times they gave them to the fighter air crews so they could better see where were the targets that they were supposed to strike. We also did post-strike, which was a little more hazardous because particularly the North Vietnamese knew that about 20 to 30 minutes after an attack had taken place, an RF-4 flying by itself would be coming through with cameras and recording the damage that had been inflicted by the fighters earlier on. And so when I came into Southeast Asia, the RF-4 was one of the units that had some of the highest loss rates in the theater, because a couple reasons. One, you weren't as a whole group. And the second thing, if you were shot down, you had to wait for them to discover you'd been shot down you couldn't get the word out. And then secondly, wait for another wave of operations to come up and try to find where you were and then rescue you.
Right. And what sort of altitude were these missions being flown at?
They were being flown at anywhere from 200 feet to 5 to 10,000 feet. It just really depended on what kind of pictures they wanted you to take. At night, we use photo flashcards. So putting the photo flashcards out, as I recall, we were typically at 1,000 to 1,500 feet above the ground. So you could get a pretty good coverage from the flash. And like I said, during the day, it really depended on what they were looking for.
Right. And what was the, I mean, I was just wondering, what was the North Vietnamese anti-aircraft capability like?
It was pretty good. You know, they talk about the surface-to-air missiles. If you could see a missile and they didn't fire a whole bunch of them, you could normally outmaneuver them because right. You had more flight control to turn into a missile and defeat it. But when they tied that, you came down because you were afraid of the missiles, because at medium altitude, you were much more vulnerable to them. Well, now you got into the place where the anti-aircraft, the 23 millimeter or 37 millimeter, and those were pretty effective. We probably lost more airplanes with AAA fire than we did with missiles.
Right. So did you come back a couple of times with a few holes, or did you manage to escape?
Minor holes. I was never, and I saw missiles fired. Fortunately, I was in formations because we were simulating that we were wild weasels, trying to get them to react so that the real wild weasels could see where the missile sites were and then attack them. So if they fired a missile at you, and the flame from the missile stayed in a fixed position on your canopy, it was coming to you. If the missile plume that you could see was moving across your canopy or up and down, the missile was going after somebody else.
Right. Jeez. So, I mean, you say you went out. When you went out there, you knew there was a high casualty rate in these missions. How did you feel when you went on your first combat flight?
Well, obviously, you're concerned because you don't know about the unknown. So it's kind of getting, you're never comfortable because you never know when something new will occur, or you might have an aircraft malfunction or those kind of things that could make it much more challenging. But, you know, they kind of felt if you could survive your first 10 missions, you were probably going to survive.
Yeah.
Because most of the mistakes are made early on, and they're based on, well, they're based on inexperience. I mean, that's why after Vietnam, when our folks came back, our airmen, they said, you know, we need to practice in peacetime more like what we faced in combat. And so the famous red flag exercises that take place even today over the Nevada desert, of which pilots come participate at least a couple times a year, try to emulate the stress and the strain and some of the uncertainty that you would have in combat, so that when you actually went into combat, you were much more qualified to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think the RAF compete in that as well, don't they?
They do, yes. Yeah.
And what instructions were you given should you have a malfunction and you came down? Were you given training in escape and evasion techniques?
We were. We all went through a special a survival school. And because I was going into a high-risk one, I even had more advanced survival. We carried, you know, radios, we had marking flares. You tried to get back to a safe area, per se, because there were areas marked out that we knew about in Southeast Asia that were specifically set up that you try to get to, because they would periodically survey those areas a couple times a day to see if there are possibly any missing airmen or army special forces on the ground or whatever that had escaped capture and were in these areas awaiting to be picked up. So there were codes we had that we dealt with, and we kind of knew what the operations were during the day. If you were flying in the morning with a group and for some reason you were shot down, your airplane, you pretty much knew that in the afternoon there would be another group coming, and that's when you would try to communicate with them if they hadn't already become aware that you had gone down and they knew what position. If you were going down, as you were going down, you tried to get out radio calls to tell people where you were at that point before you ejected from the airplane, but that wasn't always possible.
Right. Okay. And the Phantom is a two-seater, isn't it?
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
That's correct. My backseater was a navigator, and he ran most of the cameras were in the back, although I had some camera control in the front.
Okay, and navigation was old school map, was it? Or
old school map for both of us. Now there were some covert TACAN sites in Southeast Asia for a while that we could use to kind of look at some fixed points, but most of it was exactly in what you're saying. It was reading off a map and going to the areas that they had told you they wanted you to take pictures of, and then returning back to your home base.
Right. Wow. The F-117, the B-2, and the F-22. What can you tell me about that?
When I left the SR program, I went to the Pentagon. I'd been an instructor in the SR, and I just wanted to try to do something else. After I'd been in the Pentagon for about a year and a half, because of the clearances, some of the special clearances I had in the SR program, and I was already cleared into a couple special programs, they were looking for a replacement for the individual who was responsible for all the Air Force black money. And that basically, all these programs, you know, were very compartmented per se, and we had our own review type of system. And so you basically became the person who made the presentations to the general officers. And you also, at times, would be the person that would go up on Capitol Hill and talk to certain cleared House and Senate, that typically on the Armed Services Committee, it was the majority leader and the minority leader, the same on the House Armed Services Committee. They would talk to their fellow members and say, vote yes or no. On these coded, you know, the 117 line didn't say F-117. The 117 line said have blue.
So
that was the code name.
By black money, you mean military funding that wasn't defined to any projects. It was set aside for
exactly right
projects.
It was hidden inside the budget. I mean, it was all counted in the budget, but it was hidden in the budget. Congress reviewed it, gave us special permission to use the money differently. And so when I came in the program, the 117 was already flying. It was in advanced tests, and we were actually building the airplanes. They were in production. And I took some of the senior leaders down to Burbank, where the production line was taking place, so they could see it and understand what the airplane was all about. And at that time, we were fielding the 117s up at an air base in northern Nevada desert called Tonopah. And that's where the shelters would be built. We were in the process of Northrop had the contract. They had already won the contract for the B-2. And we were in the design and fabrication process at this point. I basically handled all the black money for the Air Force 1983 through 1984, 2 years. And I would go out with different leaders to have them introduced to where we were doing the work in Los Angeles for the B-2. Discussions like with General Welsh, who was the vice chief at the time, should the B-2 have two seats or three seats in it. Originally, we thought we were going to have two pilots and a navigator and bombardier type. And the decision was made. It's plumbed. They could put a seat in sometime later structurally. But the decision was made that you only have two pilots and that they would fulfill all those roles. And we had no idea we'd be flying that airplane for 40 hours, that these pilots would literally be sleeping on cot and exchanging. They take off with both in the seat. They refuel with both in the seat. They bomb with both in the seat. And they land with both in the seat. But the rest of the time, they're switching among themselves and have learned some really interesting sleep habits. Now, the F-22 was different because when I came in the program, the kind of the request for proposals was out. So you had seven different companies that I basically went out with General Larry Welsh, who would later become the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. And we reviewed the proposals that they had for what this, the F-117, yes, we call it a stealth fighter, but think of it really as a stealth bomber. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very low stealth, but high maintenance to keep that the radar signature low. But it was really a bomber. It carried two 2,000-pound bombs and basically bombed optically. You had a very advanced FLIR system there that could lock on the target, and then you could drop the laser-guided, not laser-guided. Well, yeah, I guess it was a laser-guided bomb to the targets you'd identify. The F-22 was going to be a stealthy fighter, air-to-air fighter with super cruise, could cruise at a Mach 1.5 in mil power, not an afterburner, and have all kinds of advancements. So basically, the time period I was in the program, we were going around and reviewing like what did General Dynamics want to do? What did McDonnell wanted to do? What did Boeing wanted to do? What did Lockheed wanted to do? I'm missing somebody. But anyway, as I was leaving the program, they down selected to Lockheed and Northrop. And then you had the fly off between the YF-22 and the YF-23. Which would take place through the development through the 80s. The fly-off would take place either late 80s or early 90s. Lockheed was selected, and the F-22 would be built. The sad thing is we didn't build the right number. After you've invested all that money and all that time to develop such a magnificent airplane, we were originally going to buy 750, and we all knew you weren't going to buy that. It then went down to 600 and something, and then went down to 500. I think when I left, we were in the 600 range. Then it dropped down somewhere. The wall came down, other things changed, you know, pieces breaking out. We don't need as many. Wrong. And they dropped from 325 down to what we ended up building, 187, 189, which is too small. You know, they're really stressed, particularly if you have multiple activities that are trying to take place because numbers do count. Mm-hmm. And now we're looking at another generation of fighters. It would be much better, just like the B-2.
Yeah.
We're supposed to have 132 of them. And you invested all that money and you end up with 21. And now we're developing a new bomber because we just didn't build enough of them. It was really penny wise and pound foolish on the part of the Congress, because the right number for the B-2 probably would have been something like we did for the FB-111 or the B-58. If okay, you don't build 132, but let's build 60 to 70. That would have been a much more manageable number.
Yeah. It's interesting because with the U.S., I mean, you rarely buy aircraft from other countries. I think the only example I can think of, and I think you built them under license, was the Harrier.
That's right. Well, the B-57, the Canberra, that was a British airplane.
Yeah, and NASA but still fly right. those, don't they?
Yes, they do. The long wing ones.
Yeah,
they use it for communication relay. They're a great airplane for that. So, over Afghanistan, because the communication is so terrible.
Yeah, It's incredible how long that's been, you know, been used for. And is the U2 still flying as well?
Oh, more than ever. It's the number one requested airplane in the different theaters. And the reason for that, Ian, is that fairly inexpensive to operate. True, you don't get long hours, but the longest mission is probably 10 or 11, and that stretches the pilot. 4,000 pounds of sensors, some of the most advanced sensors in the world, these hyperspectral type of sensors, but the information comes off the airplane as it's being collected. And plus, at this high altitude there, it picks up communications. It intercepts radio calls between forces and things like that that can go directly to people to analyze half the world away because you keep moving it. The U-2 pilot doesn't do that.
Yeah.
It kind of does this, some of the same functions, but not, I mean, the rivet joint, the RC-135 that the UK, our Royal Air Force now has three of, is much more effective at that because of the size of the antennas that they can put in that airplane that you can't carry on a U-2. The spectrum of frequencies that you can intercept in an RC is far greater, particularly the low frequency ones, than you can do with a U-2.
Yeah.
But the U-2, you can almost count on 24 hours a day somewhere in the world, there's a U-2 over Iraq, Afghanistan, in the Mediterranean, in Middle East. We're still doing the Camp David Accords. A couple times a month, the U-2 flies with a regular camera down over Egypt, Israel, Jordan, and maybe part of Syria. And then that film is given to each one of those governments. It was supposed to be for, in 1976, it was supposed to be done for 6 months. And here we are, still doing it, you know, all these years later. They're flying along the Korean DMZ regularly.
And are these the original airframes or are new ones being built?
They're all new. The ones that are being flown today are not the ones that Gary Powers' father flew, or that Gary Powers flew. These were basically the advanced ones that are 40% bigger. Almost all of them were built in the 80s. They're actually fairly young airplanes.
And that was a plane that was originally designed, what, in the late 40s?
No, it was designed in 7 months in the 50s. I think Kelly Johnson got the contract in late 54. The first flight of a U-2 was 7 months later, and I think it was operational 19 months from the time the contract was signed.
Wow. That's an unbelievable.
Yeah,
short,
think about it in terms today.
Yeah. And I understand that you were instrumental in getting Gary Powers Jr. up in a U-2.
I was. And matter of fact, I went to the chief of staff of the Air Force after we'd worked some of the stuff. He was Mike Ryan was two classes ahead of me at the Air Force Academy. So I've known Mike a long time. And I said, Mike, we got a great opportunity. You know, we've got all the approval. Why don't we fly Gary Powers Jr. on the 1st of May, 2000, 40 years after his father was shot down? Because I think it'll get some very positive press coverage, which it did. And they then presented his mother a bunch of medals that the father should have received that never did, you know, because he came back kind of underneath a cloud.
Yeah,
people,
he did.
People thought he should have killed himself or done something else. And that was really not the part of what they signed up to. I mean, they carried the cyanide, either the pin or the pill, if they wanted to, but it was optional. It was not a mandatory type of a thing.
Yeah. And they weren't even officially military either.
No, they had come out of the Air Force, and they were now civilians working for the CIA.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I had a great chat with Gary Powers Jr. A few weeks back. And
he's a wonderful guy. I've known him since the 90s.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's been instrumental in a lot of stuff with the Cold War Museum.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's, you know, we're this podcast is sort of now working in a partnership with the Cold War Museum. So
I saw that when I went to the site.
Yeah, yeah. So this interview that I'm doing with you will be another one that's, you know, part of that partnership. No, it's a great project. It's surprising that somewhere like the U.S. hasn't got a national Cold War museum of some kind.
You know, that's a good point. I think they've kind of relegated that to there is, you know, at the Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, one of the hangars, because I think there's either four or five hangars now, but one of the hangars is the Cold War hangar. So that's where they kind of display the Cold War aircraft and missiles and helicopters and those kind of things. But there's not a separate one like you're depicting.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I have a quick chat with you about Ramstein? So you were wing commander there after the Cold War?
No. Well, yes, because the wall had come down. And I had the support wing, which was, think about that as a super base commander, because I had 5,000 people working for me. I had 1,000 Germans and 4,000 Americans, because it's the largest air base in Europe. Plus, we had 65,000 total Americans in that part of that were part of the Ramstein base complex, per se.
Yeah.
So it was quite a thing. And I was a commander during Desert Storm. It was a very busy time period working with our NATO alliance. We did a lot of things at Ramstein. There was training, looking at, you know, Saddam Hussein was really, he was dumb, but he was really also unlucky, because East and West Germany were now coming together. Now you've got the invasion of Kuwait. The Russians, it's kind of a, you know, the glossiness, the friendly time period. So the Russians shared a lot of stuff with us. And in East Germany, I can't remember the name of the range. There was a range, but they had a number of the Soviet missile sites and other stuff that the Germans basically ran, former East Germans mm-hmm. ran. So you were able to run our Allied airplanes against the type of defenses that the Iraqis were going to throw up.
Right.
So you could see if are your electronic countermeasures going to work. And, you know, one of the things, like the French were only allowed to fly, much to their chagrin, but they understood why, in the western part of Iraq, because the Iraqi Air Force also had Mirages, and they were trying to reduce the possibility or probability of fratricide.
Yeah, blue on blue.
Blue on blue type of a thing.
Yeah.
The French two-star was a wonderful guy that was there at Ramstein, not officially on the base, but he was there, was kind of chagrined because he became the commander down there, and the French government told him, "We want you to perform well, but do not lose any airplanes." And he came to me and says, "What kind of a warrior am I that my most important guidance is don't lose any airplanes.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been a really interesting period because...
Oh, it was.
Obviously, everything prior to then had been geared up for Warsaw Pact, you know, Soviet. And then there's almost a complete re-pivot. And suddenly you're best buddies with your former enemies to some degree.
And that's true. And the other thing that you highlight there is that all the wings in Europe, I'm speaking of the American wings, we were the supported ones. Forces and supplies were going to flow into us to deal with the Fold the Gap and the Warsaw Pact and all that. Yeah. Now, all of a sudden, we are the supporters. The war is not here. It's in the Middle East. And we have to send, we have to change our whole routine because now we have, I had 800 people down in Saudi Arabia supporting the operation. So it was a complete change of mind. And when you went from being the one who was doing the conflict, being supported, to the one who was supposed to provide the supplies.
Yeah, because Ramstein would have been a big reforger base.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it was.
Or the reforger base.
Yeah. We had more transports. I remember one night I counted, I think we had 30 some odd large airplanes on the ramp. And, you know, basically Ramstein was really a fighter base that we modified to take airlift. It was not, it's not like, it wasn't like Frankfurt, you know, designed completely for that. And we pumped more fuel than what we had thought our wartime rate would be if there had been a war in Europe. Because the pipeline was just going 24 hours a day to keep the fuel coming into us.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting what you were saying about, you know, you were testing out your electronic countermeasures in the former East Germany against the technology that you knew Saddam had. So were you talking directly with the Soviets and former East Germans about some of the capabilities there?
We clearly were talking to the former East Germans. I have no direct knowledge of the interface with the former Soviets.
Yeah.
Obviously, we knew kind of what frequencies or things like that the Iraqis were going to come up on. And exactly how they got that, if that was just taken from the East German sites that the now reunified Germany provided, you know, it's hard to say.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating period. That end of the Cold War and that sudden end to the Cold War as well.
Well, you know, my wife and I were in Berlin the weekend before the wall came down on business. And with my boss, a two-star general, and there was a couple other colonels and their wives, we had dinner Sunday night in East Berlin. Mm-hmm. Well, Saturday, we were supposed to go into East Berlin, but that's when the Communist Party had this big rally in Alexanderplatz, the big plaza in the center part of what was East Berlin.
Was this the
40th booed the Communist Party. Yeah, they booed the Communist Party off the platform. And so we're sitting there. And it was like a page out of 1984. We'd known there had been all kinds of posters and protests and stuff the day before. It was absolutely cleaned. We were being followed, probably by the Stasi, because you had to be in uniform to go into East Berlin, just like the Soviets had to be in uniform to come into West Berlin.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were commenting at the end of the evening before we crossed back over. And we were on the east side of Brandenburg Gate looking west. Mm-hmm. And looking at each other said, you know, change is coming. But your wildest imagination, you couldn't have predicted that 4 days later it would occur and it would occur peacefully.
Mm-hmm.
That was our least probable scenario.
Yeah.
There was a whole bunch of other ones, you know, civil war, coups, all kinds of bad things, but to have the wall breached and what happened, and then the domino effect of all the, you know, the former satellite countries all of a sudden collapsing also.
Yeah. No, incredible times. Now, I understand your retirement is keeping you quite busy as well with the Smithsonian, amongst others.
It does. And I'm also working with 29 other museums in that have blackbirds, including Duxford. I was at Duxford about 2.5 years ago. 85 pilots and about 85 navs flew the airplane operationally during the 25 years we operated it.
Yeah. And I think you said to me 12 lost, none through enemy action.
That's correct. We built 32. And when I give tours, I tell people the part of the reason we lost so many early on, there was no modeling and simulation. This airplane was built with a slide rule. You had to take it up and try and see what worked. Well, some of the things didn't work. It was as simple as that. The good news is, and something my wife relished, because she knew how much I love flying the airplane, we never had an Air Force fatality. And there was only one, there was a Lockheed test engineer killed on a test flight trying something new in an SR. The pilot survived. And in the A-12 program, there were two pilots killed. But that's the total of it. And you consider that you had to take it out and try it. We had a wonderful rocket ejection seat that was good. I mean, if you got to the point you didn't have any options, you did have the option because the ejection seat would save your life.
Yeah. Even at Mach 3 or?
Yep. The one that the test engineer was killed, the airplane came apart at 3.12 Mach at 82,000 feet. I think he got hit by a piece of the airplane as it was disintegrating. Right. I may be wrong on that.
Right.
But he was the only one that died as a result of it. Well, I thought Spielberg did a good job on The Bridge of Spies.
Yeah.
Because I actually met Gary Powers. They brought him up to Beale so he could see it, SR. And he spent a day with us about 5 months before he died in that helicopter accident.
Right. Buzz, I really appreciate your time tonight. I'd like to say thank you for your service as well.
I appreciate it. Thank you for what you're doing, because I really think history is just not being taught to our younger generation as it should be.
Cold War, you know, there's a lot of focus on World War One, World War Two, and rightly so, but Cold War, a lot of kids out there have no idea
what
went on. So, you and me both, we're still on a mission.
So, you got it. So, well, it was great talking with you, and I look forward to maybe sometime meeting you over in the UK.
Yeah, sure thing. Sure thing. All right. Thank you very much, Buzz.
Take care.
Well, that's it for part two of our Cold War conversation with Buzz Carpenter. Our show notes contain a number of interesting links to information. Our show notes are at coldwarconversations.com. Just click on the episodes and show notes option on the homepage and scroll down. If you like what you are listening to, do join our vibrant Facebook discussion group where there's loads of Cold War information and further discussions with our guests. Just search Cold War Conversations on Facebook. Lastly, do leave reviews with your podcast provider. It really helps to spread the word. Thank you very much for listening and supporting the podcast. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Liberty's leave policy was tremendous. Having the ability to take 16 weeks off, fully paid to bond with my child, was an incredible experience.
At Liberty Mutual, you can find a career that supports you at every step, even baby steps. We offer up to 16 weeks parental leave for new moms and dads. And because not everyone's pathway to parenthood looks the same, we offer robust fertility, surrogacy, and adoption benefits too. Learn more at libertymutualcareers.com and pursue your tomorrow today.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.